Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, it's Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Nate Klarfeld, and tonight's guest is Jim Provenzano, the author of the novel Pins, Monkey Suits, and Cyclozin, and a fourth novel we'll be talking about later. He's also published numerous short stories, freelance articles. He's the curator of Sporting Life, and here is the handsome and sexy writer, Jim Provenzano. Hey, Jim. Good evening.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me on.
I want to make a little confession here. I have been a fan of yours for years. I have all of your torn-up books on a shelf. Just when you emailed me and asked if I was interested in having you on the show, I went, right away, yes. Okay, so that was it.
I love beat-up, torn copies of my book. I really love when people do that. You know,
a
fresh copy is nice, but a used one is always even much more interesting.
That's fine. I have a history of about 12 years working with gay and lesbian literature through the Stonewall National Museum and Archives, America's largest gay and lesbian library. I was the board chair and several other positions there. And I put you in your four novels, well, at least in Pins and in the new novel, Every Time I Think of You, there I see three phases of gay literature. The first phase, of course, was the coming out, the angst. It took about 100 years. Everyone committed suicide at the end. And then, unfortunately, we had the AIDS plague, and we had the deaths and the mourning and the memories and the hope and all the other stuff. And now I think we're in phase three, and that's where you come in, where people write these novels and these stories, and just some of the characters just happen to be just fabulous. And that's what you were doing now. These are great novels. They're deeper than just the predictable ending. So tell me, obviously, your first novel and your fourth novel had to do with sports. Were you an athlete in school?
Just track team. So there's a little bit of my own personal references in Every Time I Think of You with the track team, but I wasn't a distance runner. I was a sprinter.
Okay.
And I wrestled as an adult after age 30, actually.
Right.
So the stuff in Pins is completely fictional, but yet I observed matches, I went to tournaments, I competed, but I referenced other, crimes that were in the news, but it's not autobiographical. I did not grow up in New Jersey. I was not a wrestler or Catholic in high school, and a lot of people think that that was all, and it's not. It's a fictional, story.
You've just burst my bubble. Anyway, let me talk to the listeners a little bit about Pins. Pins stands for, it's not pin, it's of course a dual meaning pin for a wrestling thing, but it stands for person in need of supervision. It is about a high school wrestling team. It does get into some crimes, some beatings, some big crimes and little crimes, and guilt and sex and sweat and wrestling matches. And most of all, it was fun to read at the time I read it. When was Pins written?
I published it in 1999 in October.
Okay, 1999. This is 12 years before the It Gets Better. Yet it's about bullying, isn't it?
It is. And it's like the thing I noticed with some of the crimes that I'd heard were there were always these like trios or quartets of boys who would beat up on one more seemingly gay kid. And there was one interview on the Phil Donahue show, this is the early 90s, and I taped it, that it just struck me that one of the kids was gay, and he was just going along with it to try to not be gay or not be perceived as gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I really saw a story in that. What happens to, the one kid among this gang who is trying to be something he's not? And that really stuck. And, there was a lot of issues with Pins that I think I took on a lot. And conversely, with a different take on the coming-of-age novel with Every Time I Think of You, I really wanted to set it in a time where that wasn't, I didn't try to take on all these crimes and all this hatred and stuff. I really wanted to depict a kind of halcyon time when I was growing up. The only autobiographical aspect of my fourth novel is that I am the age at the time of the characters, that there was a moment, after Stonewall and before AIDS took on, where it was kind of okay in certain spots to be gay and nobody really cared.
Mm-hmm.
And these were smart kids compared to the kids in Pins that were intuitive but inarticulate. I wanted to have smart kids who could talk to each other.
Right.
And that's the big difference with the new book.
Okay, we'll talk about the new book in a minute because I just want to move on. I want to move on to your progression of novels because they're really interesting. I didn't ever map them out. I just mapped them out because I was going to be organized tonight. So you were way ahead of your time with Gay Teen Bullying. You were talking about gay sports in the 90s, way before it became. It was like, almost, God, gay jocks? Come on, you know, give me a break. We're all still, you know, doing decorating. But, you know, really became, and now, of course, coming-of-age novels, teen novels have everything from, you know, mystery writers to Hispanic musicians to all sorts, every single sport is involved in novels now. So you were about 12 years ahead of your time with Pin. The two novels in the middle, Cyclos in Monkey Suits, I'm going to talk about them just for a couple seconds and ask you some questions. They kind of had a different, they completely went away from sports, of course. What was the motivation for that?
Actually, Monkey Suits I wrote before I wrote Pins, and I put it aside because it was kind of didn't interest me as much. Uh-huh. And Cyclosin was also in one that I had pieces of it, and I wasn't done. And then I realized, okay, let's finish this. I consider them my pre-ACT UP and post-ACT UP novels. Uh-huh. I mean, both of them have a quite more bit of autobiographical hints, as anyone who knew me in New York knows. Uh-huh. I was a cater waiter, and I basically got out of that because of ACT UP. It woke me up. And when the two worlds clashed, can't live in both of them, although some people did. Then Cyclosin was about the death of the tribe. I mean, compared it to the tribe of centaurs, that as it faded and everyone got kind of bored or sick or moved to the suburbs, it was like, well, what happened? Now what? And I didn't want to write the entire history of ACT UP in a novel because I think its own amazing story is beyond fiction. It was just so amazing. But I could bracket my work around how I got into it and what happened after it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the characters did in those two books were existing in the same space and time, but none of them are related, and the voice is very different. Mm-hmm. But they're very much, you know, of things that happened to me.
We're about the same age. We're not going to tell everyone how old we are.
I'm 50.
I'm proud of it. I'm too. I'm 61 and even prouder because I'm here. Goddamn it. Anyway, and I don't look it, and you don't look it, so we're great, okay? I mean, does the vanity ever leave? Okay, no, it doesn't. I had a question here. Here it comes. So I lived through funerals that I stopped counting and memorial services that I stopped counting. Of course, you probably did too. Was this your way of writing Monkey Suits and Cyclosin? Was this your way of journaling it or getting it out or doing a catharsis?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, there are people, there are specific people that died who are I base characters on in both those books that people know. Jake Corbin, the porn star, is Jake Stallion in the book.
Oh, really? And, okay. Uh-huh, okay.
And there are many other people who are gone, who some I actually use their names, and others, you know that they're in there, and they laugh because they survived. So it was very personal.
Oh, good. Yeah, it felt personal when I read both books. I reread the books thank God, and I reread the books and I said, you know, these books go together. Obviously, Monkey Suits and Cycles and kind of coming pre-ACT UP, post-ACT UP. You know, the beginning of something burning and then the explosion and then of course the burning out, all in two novels, which is amazing. And I don't want to spend a whole lot more time on them because I want to talk about Every Time I Think of You, and some of the other things you've done, but there's the Monkey Suits, by the way, you mentioned it's about cater waiters, you know, the dual life they lead and things like that. For the listeners who haven't read every single one of your books, of course, everyone has. There are five gay characters. I can't remember. Is that right? Are there five?
Four and a half.
Okay. That's why.
One of them isn't exactly gay.
That's right. Well, that's, and I think that's pretty funny too, but are all of those you?
No, see, I did live in Jersey City the way Jay is a character, but I kind of broke up myself up and used bits of friends. Because I realized that all my books have like a kind of metaphoric, symbolic understory that, you know, I'm not trying to be clever. It just helps me write the story.
Right.
With monkey suits, it was basically a comparison to Egyptian slave culture, which
right.
is kind of preposterous because these are all a bunch of middle-class kids who, you
right.
know, work for $20, $30 an hour. But
right.
there was the Temple of Dendur was a very inspirational setting for the beginning and ending. And so I used the elements, the four elements
uh-huh.
for the four main characters of earth, fire, water, right. and the other one.
Oh, okay.
And Richie, the mostly straight one, is a sculptor who,
right.
in ceramics, a piece of his sculpture becomes very pivotal. Piece
right.
in the work, and that of course brings all four elements together.
Right.
So as
right.
I was writing it, I didn't do this on purpose. It was like, oh, this is working. This could be this, and this could be that, and
right.
you know, along with doing this kind of gossipy, you know, page six boldface writing style, as if it were a gossip columnist writing the story, or a society columnist, etc. These people were really not supposed to be completely formed.
Right.
They're more like New Yorker cartoons or caricatures or etchings, not fully formed characters. And some people critiqued it for that in a bad way, but it's like I'm glad they noticed that these were not complete people until they escaped this world and until
right.
they became themselves.
And they were kind of actors, and they weren't really slaves because they were wearing tuxedos. All right, I got you to laugh three times. That's good. All right, every time I think of you, I'm just going to say something really quick before you get started, and you probably have heard it 100 times from people of our age. It is, again, a sports novel. You've gone back to the sports novel, but you've taken a gay sports novel, but you've put an incredibly heartwarming, and for me it was a little scary as I was reading it because I didn't know what was going to happen, but you put a disability, a disabled person, a disabled gay person, into the mix. And from maybe about the 23rd, 24th page, I said, oh my God, it's a novel I read in high school, a separate piece, but it's gay.
Oh God.
Well,
I would never try to be like John Knowles. I could never match him, but yes, a lot of people have made those references. I think it's because Reed, the narrator, is kind of enchanted by this upper class, you know,
right.
the other person, Everett, and
right.
there is that perspective of him being the observer and being, you know, brought into this life of a wealthy kid from the other
mm-hmm.
side of the forest, literally.
Right.
But yeah, I was not at all trying to imitate or even compare to the greatness that is John Knowles, is that book and his other work.
Right, but I think the structure of the narrator and the longing and the duality, though there really wasn't much duality in being out and being gay in this novel, I think that was just kind of, you know, I'm gay, that's over, and then the rest of it was into the family and the interactions. But very powerful characters. Now, if your characters were incomplete in the Cyclos and Monkey Suits, the characters in this novel is just absolutely full and rich, and I did not want this book to end. I had so much fun.
Thanks. I had a strange and wonderful time cranking this out because the first and third and I think sixth chapter were based on dreams I had one night, and
mm-hmm.
I just woke up and started typing. And
mm-hmm.
thankfully, it was a weekend, and I didn't go back to bed. It wasn't just a dream journal. It was like, oh. And then I realized I had two, and then three, and then five fully formed characters and scenes.
Right.
And I basically forced myself. I said 500 words a day. This is all for 2011.
Uh-huh.
And I forced myself to write something. And
sure.
so it was a much more impulsive book. It was a less thought out, and it's a little floppy in some parts, I'll admit. But I really wanted to let the characters tell me what was going on and let them speak for themselves. And maybe it's because I've learned how to do this over the years, but it was a real fun adventure to let them say, oh, now this is good. Oh, let's do this. And
mm-hmm.
instead of, it has to be according to the master plan of my, you know, grand scheme,
right.
and I didn't do that.
Right. So you didn't have a chart on the wall with all the stickers on the wall with what happens next on a timeline. And
no, but what's different this time is I had to do a bunch of research, of course, about the setting and the time. I had to remember what songs were prevalent, and that inspired the title. And I had
uh-huh.
to remember specific things that are to avoid anachronisms. I had to find out about what was and was not available in 1979
mm-hmm.
and
right.
in terms of, you know, stem cell research wasn't even a phrase. So when a kid gets a spinal cord injury, and what position and what vertebrae and what could happen and what can't happen, it was
right.
it was really fascinating, and that led to me realizing how many people I know who are in my life who are disabled, and this is why it inspired me. There were three guys in high school, one later on in college, who are, you know, paraplegics. And I forgot that I really, you know, I didn't know them well, but they were friends, and there are people in my life. I worked for a guy with MS who in a medical lab, and there are a lot of disabled people in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a dance company, Axis Dance Company, that was very inspirational to me. And just seeing, visualizing people in wheelchairs, these are accomplished dancers in and out of wheelchairs who can move in all kinds of ways that you wouldn't think possible. So it made me see how to physicalize those movements, at which, fortunately, there will be more, because I realize that I want to write more about these characters, and of course it's not done. This is the first time I've ever thought of doing a sequel, because usually when you set up a symbolic story, the story is over when you finish it, and this one didn't have some, you know, it didn't have that spine, ironically, to it. So it's like, oh, well, they're going off to college. Well, duh, of course you want to write a sequel, because I want to know what happens with these guys.
Sure,
I'm curious.
Right. And you did touch on something very – that I mean, you have had experience with handicapped people. I have in my past profession. But, you know, most people – a lot of people haven't. Black people shun handicapped people, even within their own families. And yet you made a character that can not only have love, he can have gay love. And you specifically – and I wanted – you know, not I wanted to tell listeners that not only did you have him what was there and what the injury was, you figured out how he could have sex and how he could have a relationship and how he could have just kissing and cuddling and sleeping and things like that. And that all was very carefully orchestrated. Obviously, every movement is orchestrated when you're handicapped. And this novel had this incredible detail, which was beyond just, you know, movement, but and I don't want to, you know, dwell too much on sex, but it's something that everyone was in the back of everyone's mind. Oh, he'll never have sex again. Oh, poor guy, you know, he's not going to, and you proved that wrong again.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me, too. I had to, you know, some people I know were like, I didn't want to go there, so I had to do my own research.
Uh-huh.
And others were really open about it. And I researched and I said, you know, what can and can't do this sex. And even had characters towards the end.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much like what most people who don't know. That's one of the first questions that pops out when they get to talk to someone. And, you know, you wouldn't really do that to someone who wasn't disabled. So it's kind of awkward and stupid, but at the same time, it's a general curiosity that people have. So I'm already written chapters for the hopeful sequel where Reed and Everett confront that with other people, other people who seem to be sympathetic but don't know the boundaries of, you know, is it really your business? And how open are they going to be? And how creative can they be? You know, from being early in the book, it's very impulsive. Their problem is, how can we get together? Where can we get together?
Right.
And then it's, well, now we're together, and now where can we go from here? Now that, you know, that they've achieved this level of intimacy.
Correct. And that's kind of like the whole, you know, as a relationship develops, you realize that, you know, relationships are about compromise, making sacrifices, accepting your partner as how he was. But this is a big sacrifice for this young man. It's his first love, and he has to basically, the abled person has to basically change his entire life, which is something that you don't always think of, that if when there's a partner or a family member or a parent, you know, but this person had a choice. He had a choice to leave, and he decided to stay. And
I think there's a kind of puppy dog aspect to, I mean, he does get attached to Everett Reed does. And I think he just transcends that because it's like, well, why wouldn't I?
Right. And that's, you know, and that's part of the love story, the cute love story. People our age, you know, talk about teenagers all the time like that, cute. But for them, it's real. and you captured it and all the other things. Listen, I want to ask you about a couple of other things. How's the book? The book is available on, 805-830-8355 is our call-in number for questions, 805-830-8355. Call that number and dial 1, and you'll be able to get in the queue, and I'll put you on right away. And I'm going to do another little plug for Jim. The novels are called, the books are called Pins, Cyclozin, Monkey Suits, Every Time I Think of You, and they're all available on Amazon.com and your Kindle and ebook. So
yes.
I was going to ask you this because I speak to authors and publishers two or three times a week, and you know, I hear the good, the bad, and the ugly. What do you think about where publishing, publishing is going, and then gay publishing is going as far as fiction?
Well, I've always been independent because I write really bad query letters, so I've been in Lambda winning fiction anthologies when I had a short story. But after, you know, things got rejected by 60 different editors and publishers, so I just gave up and just did it myself. And I pretty much had a good time doing it. You know, the good part is you can determine everything on your own, and the bad part is you have to do everything. But I learned everything, and I learned everything I could about the industry. And what really amazed me this time around, as I was finishing, every time I cranked out the previous three on Kindle, and I was just so surprised by how quickly people snapped them up.
Right.
How a book that they thought was out of print, or they can buy in print, but they'd rather just have the Kindle. And I'm really happy with the amount of people who want to buy, you know, my books on Kindle. You know, sadly, I was going through my promotion when I finished every time. I went going through my press list and bookstores, and half of them were gone.
Correct.
So I couldn't send it in anything because they were gone. So I really want to help, you know, independent bookstores at the same time, but it's just so easy to self-publish and to do it online or to do it with a, you know, it's not a vanity press. Thousands and thousands of people are doing it like this anymore. I have a Kickstarter campaign to ask people to help me do research on the sequel because I need to go to Philadelphia, where I haven't been in 15 years, and really get the facts right and stuff and make a book that's worth buying. That's what it's about. You know, I think there's a sad kind of downgrading of gay fiction thanks to Amazon and Kindle. There's a lot of, like, different books. I don't want to be judgmental, but, I mean, there's a lot of books that are selling more than what you'd call literature because there's, you know, a hot shirtless torso on the cover, and it's really that's what it is. It's a lot of erotica. And it's fascinating because a lot of it's written by women, this male-male romance genre. I mean, this is why I got the Lambda Literary nomination, I have to tell you, because I put it in the romance category. I did not want to compete against Alan Hollinghurst and Edmund White again. So it is a romance, and I was proud to call it a romance, but I think that term has been kind of like given second tier because it's really just erotica dressed up. Mm-hmm. And I don't think my work is that, and I don't mind work that's that. But that's what's selling right now, and that's what's fascinating to see what's selling now versus what was selling 10 years ago.
Right. I'm going to backtrack a little bit. You said some things that are kind of industry things, vanity press, self-publishing. Let me just give the listeners a little bit of a quick rundown. Self-publishing used to be kind of like a joke, and everyone had like an agent, and a big publisher like Simon & Schuster would put your book out, and then you made like 75 cents a book on, you know, when the book came out. And now in self-publishing, which has goods and bads, and what Jim didn't get into and what I'm going to say is Jim's books are beautifully edited, there's no grammatical mistakes, no spelling errors, things like that.
There's fewer, I would say.
I didn't find any. I'm pretty good.
Oh, anyway, there's a few.
Okay, well, see, I'm not that good. I said pretty good. Well, because people find those things. They drive you crazy because when I write a blog and then people call me and tell me that I made a mistake, and I go, Anyway, go back to the real story. You know, when you you can just upload a book. I'm going to tell people how to. You can actually go to the create part of Kindle, upload your book, figure out your cover, get your graphics, put it in there, and actually make more money, and have a less carbon footprint on the environment, and an incredible number of highly respected straight gay novelists, writers, journalists, everyone is going to the self-publishing away from the hierarchy of getting an agent, a publisher, an editor, and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
The bad news, and I can say this because I get to be judgmental because I write book reviews and interview authors, and you can't say this because you're a nice guy, is you get a lot of crap because people don't edit. There's no they don't have anybody else read it. They write it. They have a best friend read it, not a professional editor, and there's a lot of it's a very democratizing publishing world, and we hope the cream is going to rise. But as you said about the novels and the erotica, even worse than that, there's some just really bad stuff out there available at like $1.99, and sometimes you get what you pay for, and sometimes there's some great stuff for $1.99 on Kindle. So it's kind of fun.
Yes.
Yeah, and then the last thing I'm going to say about the Stonewall National Museum and Archives, I only work there one day a week, and we spoke this afternoon when I was working there, and we have our reading stacks is about 30,000 books. It's the largest collection of circulating gay and lesbian books in the world, and the last couple of 5 years, they're members of the library. They come in, they look at the book, they open their Kindle, open their iPad, order the book, and walk out. They don't check the book out. They just look at they read the first couple of pages, they look at the front and the back, and they go, okay, and that's it.
And then they order it?
They
get the Kindle version?
They get the Kindle right on our spot, put the book back on the shelf, and walk out every day.
Wow.
But it's just getting to be a very, either a Kindle version or an iBook version or any sort of an electronic reader version.
Right.
I think, you know, there's also the carbon footprint, you know. There's no paper use, there's no truck that delivered it, there's no air conditioning at the bookstore. I know I really used to love to play with the books, and for those of you that have not ever touched a Kindle or an electronic reader, you have this urge to say, I love the smell and look and feel of a book. Yeah, I know.
With Pins, I did it the old-fashioned way before all this really took over, and
right.
I had literally cartons of books in this as big as a sofa, and
uh-huh.
UPS was coming every day. I had my home business. It was great. I learned all the hard, you know, facts about keeping accounts and books and everything, and
right.
It was great to do it then, but then post 9/11, all these returns, all these books were coming back, and
right.
It was hard. It was really a hard thing to do, to lug books literally all over the country. And
right.
Now, I mean, I sold 600 Kindles in 3 months, and
right.
Not a tree was chopped down, which is,
correct.
You know, interesting compared to the tree metaphors that's literal
yeah.
imagery in the book. You
right.
know, I didn't kill as many trees this time around, so I really feel good about that.
I do too. But back to Every Time I Think of You. Did you have a moment where you wanted to do a bad ending or happy ending?
No. Right. I mean, the whole disability thing was really, I hate to use the word, accidental. I didn't
okay.
go in saying I'm going to write a novel about disability. That was a spontaneous thing where it was a eureka moment where I realized this was going to happen. But no, I liked the guys too much. But if you look at the timeline in the possible sequel, AIDS does approach them.
Right.
But I'm not going to give anything else away. But they confront it. Let me put
okay.
it that way. In the horrifying early 80s where
uh-huh.
nobody knew what it was. I mean, I realize
right.
that's where they're going into. So it's kind of like, you know, there's this huge cloud looming in the background. And if you read the book, you think, oh, well, it's happy time. And it's like, no, they're going into it. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I have other books that really are immersed in it. And
right.
those will come later.
Right.
But, you know, that's the thing. It's like I was thinking about nostalgia. I just watched Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris.
Oh.
And it was like the whole idea of nostalgia, that we think this older era is better. I love the 70s and the 80s, and some
uh-huh.
of my college friends from Kent State are listening, and I had a great time in the 80s and
uh-huh.
when I was young. But I don't know if it was a better time. I just know that this is the time that I set this book, because I don't want to talk about Facebook and cell phones and cable
right.
TV. I wanted to
okay.
talk about the characters, really whittle it down to just the characters and their family, and not this cluttered world that we're in now.
Okay, another reference to a separate piece. They have World War II looming over them at the end. You know that, right?
Well, that would I have
okay,
to reread
okay.
that. Yeah, I mean, it's looming, and Phineas is in denial and thinks it's all a conspiracy. So,
right.
you know, I mean, maybe I'll reference that too, because I think it's pretty fascinating. But yeah, it's something that you this is why I want to go to Philly and research more,
right.
because there's. I know that one look through, and Mark Siegel with Philadelphia Gay News invited me to go
right.
look through the archive.
Oh, good.
One look
good.
Through old newspapers, and the journalist in me goes, oh, my God, there's a story. You know, you can kind
right.
of zealot them and make them
right.
kind of there, but not, you know, make up reality. But you
right.
have to use, I like to use real events to springboard
oh, sure.
into
sure.
a fictive, you know, world. That makes
You're...
a logical sense.
Mm-hmm. You're a journalist. Listen,
Well, I've written science fiction, but I haven't
right.
written enough of it. I mean, I like a story that's based in something real that you can
right.
hold on to.
Right. And what do you have to say? This is we're off going off the air in like 30 seconds. The fastest 30 minutes of your life, right? So what do you want to say to a young gay writer out there itching to write his first novel? What are you going to say?
Get published in small bits first.
Oh,
I was
good.
I was You know, short stories, blogs, newspaper articles, reviews. Get in line. The future's crowded.
Good. Thank you. That's great. You have been a joy. I'm going to have you back when I want you to talk about your Kickstarter and your next phase of Every Time I Think of You. Jim, it's been a delight. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Nate. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.